This is Circulating Ideas. I'm Steve Thomas. My guest today is Ned Potter. He's the author of the Library Marketing Toolkit, and he's a librarian from the UK, continuing our international streak of wisdom. Ned Potter, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on.
Well, thank you very much. As you know, I've been listening to this since episode one, so long-time listener, first-time appearer, and it's very nice to be on.
Well, I can say that I was thinking back to, because you've been kind of on that list that I've got of librarians that I wanted to have on the show for a really long time, so number one, I'm really glad that I was able to get you on, and number two, I realized that a lot of the conversations that I was reading before I started the show on Twitter and blogs and stuff about the librarians being in the echo chamber and all that, and you were a big part of that, and that is actually one of the big reasons that I started doing the show, so it's partially your fault that I'm doing the show in the first place.
Well, that's a fantastic, that's great. I'm very glad.
So that was part of the whole idea of wanting to do the show, was to get the idea of, you know, what librarians actually do out to people so they understand what it is we do, and that's what I'm trying to do with this show. So, and it also helps, I think, to tell other librarians what you're doing, because you can get ideas from other people. And
no, absolutely. I mean, that's why I like listening to this show, because every time, pretty much, there's some idea or some concept that someone talks about where I think, yeah, I could apply that to what I do in some way. I do like podcasts a lot. I like the fact you can kind of take information in on the go and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, it's good.
Yeah, I like that a lot too. I listen in the car a lot. I don't have a really long commute anymore, but I used to have a 45-minute commute to work every day, so I had a lot more time. Now I'm about 5 minutes away, so I don't have quite as much time to listen.
I have a half an hour walk into work, and my iPhone, which I listen to podcasts to on the whole journey, has started dying at 30% battery now, which is so infuriating. So I settle in for a nice, you know, entertaining walk home, and then 3 minutes in, it just dies, and it's, oh no. Yeah.
So the first thing I wanted to ask, related to the book, is why did you want to write this book? Why do you think, let's take a step back and say, what is marketing and why do you think libraries need to have marketing?
Well, marketing is, I mean, in its most basic form, it's just telling people why you might be useful to them. So, I mean, you know, if you get into the kind of proper definitions, you start to talk about how it's good marketing is a dialogue between, you know, someone who's got something and other people who might want to use that something. And I think it's fairly obvious that libraries need to communicate their value to people more so now than ever before. So it's just, I mean, yeah, the whole book is about practical ways to highlight what you do to people who might be able to use your services, really.
And I did like that you made the distinction that librarians a lot of times think marketing, they're thinking of a different thing. They're thinking of advertising or promotion or things like that.
Yeah.
When that's not actually what you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's a slightly dirty word, I think, marketing. And it, you know, it conjures up horrible images, marketing. It's like, it sort of has this idea of false or deceit or, you know, sort of slick kind of manipulation. And it's not really what it's for in the library sense. It's just communication. You know, it's just saying, this is what we can do for you, and trying to make sure that, you know, not everybody needs to use libraries. The important thing is that all of those that do, we can actually let them know that we're here and how it is that we can make their lives a little easier. So it's not just a question of saying libraries exist and this is what we do. It's very much about saying, this is how it fits in to what you as the user or potential user are doing in your life, and how it might be, you know, it might be a useful intersection there between our services and your lifestyle, as it were, you know?
Right. And a lot of times when we read those, do our libraries dead kind of articles that come out every 6 months or so and get everybody up
there. Yeah.
In a tizzy on Twitter, it's all about usually the, oh, well, libraries are just about big stacks of books and they're going away. And so, I mean, a lot of times they don't understand, number one, what we do, or like you said, how, what we offer. Cause I mean, the books and the ebooks and databases and all that stuff, they're just tools to help us help people achieve certain things. And they don't understand the end point, much less even the current tools that we have.
Yeah, and the whole echo chamber thing that you mentioned came about because it's our responsibility to make them understand that. You know, it's easy for a lazy, well, no, not even lazy journalism. You know, if you're writing about something that you're not an expert in, then of course you're going to skim the surface of it. And so what, you know, our responsibility as information professionals is to put the reality right at the surface so that when it's skimmed by people who don't know a whole lot about what we do, they do actually get good things to report in their articles. And the whole business with books, I have no wish to burn any bridges with our relationship with books. I just think that if there's one message that's loud and clear got through to the rest of the world, it's that libraries have books in. So when it comes to marketing, I think we can afford to focus on the other things and take it as a given that people are going to realise that we've got the books. So let's, you know, when it comes to actually promoting the libraries, let's talk more about the services that we offer rather than just the content that we have, so that those messages, so that when people write those articles about the future of libraries, they've got more frame of reference that we've given them than just the whole warehouse full of books things. It's up to us to have a louder voice in the narrative, and that's how the echo chamber thing, you know, developed, really.
Right, and it's a more powerful message to say a library can help you find a job than for us to say, hey, we have books about resumes.
Exactly right. It's the whole, you know, market the benefits, not the features thing. It's talking about what the impact is going to be on the person that you want to use the library rather than just what the library does. I think that's such an important thing. And as it says in the book, if there's only one, you know, thing that you do to change the way you're promoting your library, if you can just talk about the benefits all the time rather than just the features of what you do, then that's a huge step forward. So, I mean, the obvious example that I always use in workshops and stuff is I first heard Mary Ellen Bates use it, is saying that the library subscribes to 20 databases. Sounds like it's a good thing. Hey, we've got all these databases, you should come and use them, they're great. But actually, that's just the feature, and that takes a bit of a leap of faith to know that our users are going to know why that's any good. So the benefit is we've got access to good quality information that Google can't find. You know, that's why it's worth coming to us and using our electronic resources that we've, you know, invested this money in on your behalf. And too often we talk about the feature, which is we've got the databases, and that's not enough. We have to make the leap for the user as to how it's going to actually positively impact on their existence in some way.
Right, because we need to make that distinction that, yes, you can use Google to find out what the dates of the Industrial Revolution were, but perhaps there are some more in-depth scholarly articles that you cannot get through Google, and that's the kind of thing we need to be pushing into schools, is that there are things that the library can offer that you can't get on Google. Because, yes, you know, 75%, 90% of the old ready reference questions are very easily found on the Internet now.
Yeah. But, I mean, the Google example is a very easy way to kind of illustrate the benefits versus features thing. But actually, it's slightly dodgy ground, because I certainly don't think we should say, I don't like using Google as an example of what is bad and saying that libraries are good by comparison, because it's a war that we're never going to win. I mean, Google is, you know, you can't argue with Google. You can't tell people that Google isn't useful to them, because it clearly is. You know, I use it every day. I think it's extremely useful for all its flaws. So I don't like it when we make kind of explicit comparisons and say Google can do X, but we can do so much more. I'd rather just talk about what we can do and perhaps even how we can help people use Google more effectively than actually try to promote ourselves by belittling something else, or if you know what I mean.
Right. No, I was going to say, because a lot of times, I mean, using that same example of the Industrial Revolution, they can just Google the word Industrial Revolution, but if they don't understand how it's ranking and what sites that they're seeing are, I mean, they don't understand when it's highlighted in yellow, that's a sponsored link and all these other things that we understand a little more even about how to use Google. So, I mean, Google is just another tool for us to use, just like the books are.
Yeah, exactly right.
And another thing I thought was important from the book is that you talk about it's important, not only it's almost more important for you to be marketing to the people who are not currently using your library than it is to current and sort of the preaching to the choir kind of thing, that if the people are already using the library, yes, you still need to make aware of all the services that you have to offer, but maybe you should be pushing out to people who aren't using the library.
Exactly. It's really hard to do. And also, you know, from the kind of traditional marketing of non-library stuff, there's this thing that you hear about how it's 10 times harder to, what is it, you get 10 times, in terms of retaining customers as opposed to getting new ones, it's 10 times harder to get a new customer than it is to retain an old one. So there's all this emphasis on retaining existing customers. Whereas with libraries, it's so difficult to get new people that it's very easy to become focused on essentially delivering messages which are aimed at the people who already use the library or who already understand the value of the library. And that's a really hard mindset to get out of. But if you want to be really ambitious with the marketing, then you do have to think about, you know, what are the demographics that don't currently use us but would if they knew what we did? And that's hard to do. You know, it's easy to preach to the converted, and it's enjoyable to preach to the converted because you get good feedback, and it's a pleasant loop. You know, but actually, to make gains, if you want to, there are various things you can do with marketing, and an obvious one is to try and get more people in through the door. And to do that, you do have to partially target the people who aren't currently coming in through the door at all, as well as trying to get the people who already use the library to come through the door more often. And it's hard to do because it's a comfortable thing just to market to people that already like it. But if you think about a lot of the rhetoric around saving libraries and so on, it's in terms of what we value. And the people making the decisions about whether or not to close a library value completely different things, you know. And I think it's important to use the language and the what do people care about, and package up this essentially, you know, this central message that we have about why libraries are good. Package it up in different ways for those different audiences, including the audiences that don't currently use us at all, you know.
Yeah, and I think it's really important, especially in terms of public libraries, but even academic libraries to a degree, and special libraries, that we need to get out to those non-users because they're still aware, in the public library especially, my tax dollars are paying for those libraries, but if they don't see any kind of benefit from it, then they feel like that's a waste of my taxpayer dollars, and they are not going to be happy with the library because they see it as just this black hole of money.
Yes, exactly. I mean, I think it's important to understand whatever the local community is of users and potential users, what they value, and to look at what you currently offer and say, well, this part of our offer matches up with this particular user group. And if there's nothing in what you currently do that really appeals to, you know, the people of your town, then that in itself is instructive because you can think about what you could start to do which would be appealing to them so that they do get this sense of value from what their tax dollars are going into.
And another group that I know you talk about marketing to is doing internal marketing as well, of explaining to the people who maybe they might be external users as well, but they're the people who maybe control your purse strings. And those are the people you really need to market to as well, and to the people who work for your organization. Everybody needs to understand the importance of the organization.
Yeah, and it's easy to not do that because, everybody's time is extremely pressed. We've only got limited resources. But actually, the kind of internal marketing, the marketing upwards, essentially, to people who are in the organization or the parent organization of the library, is really important because as much as, you know, if you've got a chance to make an impact on one group, to get, 100 new users through the door is a fantastic achievement. And if you can do that, that's brilliant. But if you get that and don't spend any time marketing to people who actually control the purse strings and they don't care about the 100 new users and then they slash the budget and they cut staff or whatever, it's almost for nothing that you've got the new people in. So there's a sense where you've really got to concentrate on targeting what resources and time and money and staff that you've got to put into the whole area of communicating the value of the library towards the people that are actually going to have a massive say in the future of the library. And obviously, you know, there are a lot of libraries which aren't under any kind of threat at all. And in that situation, you adapt and you can focus much more on just the external users. But it's important in most cases, I would say, to highlight the value to people who you might assume know the value, but actually they don't. And again, to use the kind of criteria that they find important rather than just the kind of stuff that we actually see day to day.
Right. I mean, if you're like if you're at a university, you want to make sure the faculty understands the importance of the library. The president of the university understands the
exactly
the deans. They need they're the ones that need to understand the importance of the library. The students do as well, obviously, but.
But it feeds down to them as well. You know, if you can convince the faculty of the value of the library, then that whole attitude in the department towards the library will be positive, and the students will be more predisposed towards, you know, thinking that it's something worthwhile in the first place. So, but equally, you know, if you can convince the students that the library is fantastic, but you don't have any influence on the, you know, the vice chancellor or the principal of the higher education institution itself, then you could find yourself in a situation where the feedback from the students is great, but gradually you become marginalized in the actual the organization that you're in, because the people at the top don't realize how the library is important to them. You know, it might just be something as basic as saying this is going to make you look good, but it's still about getting through to them why they need you, as opposed to just why the students need you, for example.
Right. I mean, a lot of time, I mean, appealing to someone's self-interest a lot of times is a good way to market.
It's a very good way to market. In fact, it's a, you know, it's a kind of a nice golden rule, really, as sad as it is to say. But yeah, if you can, you need to find out what makes someone tick in relation to what you do, and then talk about that. You know, it's just about packaging up the message that you have in a way that appeals to this particular audience. And that's one of the big differences between actually doing marketing as opposed to just doing one-off bits of promotion here and there when you get a bit of time or an idea. It's about working out what it is you want to say about the organization that you're a part of, and then how that message can be tailored to suit different audiences. That's a big part of proper marketing, which yields more kind of tangible results than the odd, big kind of splash that then doesn't get followed up by any other marketing.
Right. One of the examples you use in the book is that putting a sign on a yellow piece of paper written in Comic Sans, we have this new database, that's not marketing.
Yeah, I got in trouble for that. I had to take out references to Comic Sans. My publisher was extremely good at just letting me get on with it and not interfering, but I had so many references to my hatred of Comic Sans. I think they thought I came across as psychopathic, and they made me strip it down to just one or two. But I do have a problem with Comic Sans, and I do have a problem with just, the one-off poster that promotes the thing that's just happened, and then that just sort of gets lost in the midst of time. And I think that you know, this is something that Terry Kendrick, who's a really kind of great marketing guru guy from the UK, who used to work in libraries and now lectures and does a lot of work with libraries, he'll talk about this, the fact that you have to make people understand how the library is going to actually help them get somewhere that they're already going, and you have to make the people who are doing the marketing understand how if you just do a one-off piece of marketing, it's not going to have the great impact that you hoped it's going to. You know, people get discouraged because they try marketing the library by doing X, and then it doesn't really have as much of an impact as they think it's going to, so they think, well, maybe it's not worth it at all. Whereas if they did X, Y, and Z and linked them together, it would have a much more tangible effect. And if you think about what it takes to make you, as a consumer, do anything, it's certainly not one isolated incident, you know? So, you know, when I'm doing marketing workshops, I often use the example of Hellman's mayonnaise, where there are adverts for Hellman's mayonnaise on the front of NASCAR, for example. It's in magazines, it's on TV, and no one ever ran out of a NASCAR race to go and buy mayonnaise because they saw the Hellman's ad on the bonnet. But they do have the Hellman's mayonnaise in their fridge because it's the brand that they know most about. And it's because when they think about mayonnaise, when they're in the supermarket, that's when they think to themselves, oh, right, well, I'll get Hellman's because that's the one that I just know because I've seen it everywhere. And there's a sense that a lot of library marketing tries to make people rush out and buy the mayonnaise during the race, and that's never going to happen. We need to be what people think of when the need for authoritative information or whatever it might be that we offer actually comes up, rather than hoping to inspire kind of mass hysteria, library devotion, you know? So it's if you join things up, you gradually impact on people's consciousness about what it is that we do and how we can help people. And if you just do the one-off thing, it tends to disappoint. So Terry Kendrick will say, if you market strategically, then it won't be disappointing because it'll build up over time and it'll, you know, all the things work together to generally build up a perception so that people know what the library is, they know that what we can do, and they know how it applies to them.
Well, that sort of brings up something else that you have in the book, as talking about branding. What is important about branding for libraries?
Well, the thing about branding is, and again, it's straying into this slightly dirty word marketing territory. It's about making someone feel like they know where they are in a landscape. So, you know, on a literal level, it's like having a color scheme. Or a logo or whatever, where if someone's not actually in the library but they see something connected with the library, they have that familiarity that shows them, yeah, right, you're here, you're dealing with this library sphere even though you're not inside the building. And there's a lot of good things that can come about from branding well, but also you see the opposite, where the tail is wagging the dog and it becomes all about the brand, even at the expense of the brand. So the obvious thing the bit that I get wound up about is PowerPoint presentation templates, where it's considered a good idea to have the logo and the color scheme on every single one. And that makes for a really bad PowerPoint presentation. There's no point in reinforcing the brand if you're doing so in a way that makes, thank God, I'm really bored at this PowerPoint presentation. So I do think that we have to be a little bit cautious with branding exercises, which end up kind of enslaving us, you know, so that we become sort of at the whim of the brand, whereas the brand should be working for us to make our users feel like they know where they are and how these services that we offer connect and all come from the same source.
One other way we can get people involved is using advocacy as marketing.
There is a lot of advocacy work going on both sides of the Atlantic at the moment, and it is possible to link that to your specific institution while you're doing it. You know, obviously, it's about the library as a concept and as an ongoing institution being protected and being nourished and being allowed to grow. But when you're, you know, let's say, to take a kind of prosaic example, if someone is on a website of a newspaper has said something derogatory about libraries and dismissive and talked about how they don't have any value. So the easy thing to do and the echo chambery thing to do is just to talk to your librarian friend about how unfair that is and how that's, you know, bang out of order, as we would say in the UK. And that the harder thing to do is to go back and make sure that that same audience who read the dismissive thing about the library on the newspaper website gets, if possible, an alternative view about how libraries do have value. So if you're commenting on this piece and trying to set people straight about actually how the person who wrote this, they really have missed certain areas of value that the library have, then at the same time, you can talk about your specific library, about how it does do these incredible things and offers these fantastic services, and is a kind of antidote to all the negative stuff that's been written in the piece. So you're advocating for libraries generally, but you're also marketing your own institution at the same time. You know, why not?
A lot of the book that I was trying to go through and try to estimate, but I would say probably half the book is case studies from other libraries and things. How did you hook up with the people the various contributors that gave you case studies? How did you...
Yeah, it's probably about 40%, I think. It was Phil Bradley he's a kind of internet consultant. He's the president of CILIP, which is the UK sort of equivalent to the ALA. He's the current president, and he's an extremely helpful man. And before agreeing to write this book, which is something that I did with an enormous amount of trepidation, I rang him up because he'd written a bunch of books already for this publisher and just talked to him about it and got his counsel as to, you know, whether or not I should do it and how I should go about it. And one of the things he said was, people will tell you editing a book is essentially as long-winded and stressful as writing it, because you spend so much time chasing people up about, you know, the chapters that they've written and so on. So it doesn't really save time or even responsibility to be the editor rather than the author. Right. And obviously being an author of writing the whole book is an enormous responsibility. And I personally think it's a bit of a wasted opportunity just to have your own voice when you could have the others. In terms of actually finding contributors, it was a huge amount to do with with basically mining my own network that I'd already built up. So the various things that I'd done before on my blog and projects that I've been involved with has put me in touch with a whole bunch of people. And I think Twitter is a fantastic tool for, you know, just literally building a network where you have a day-to-day exchange of useful information, and you keep up to date, and you learn things about each other. But then something big comes along, like a book. You already know these people who you'd never have talked to otherwise, and can get their input. So a huge amount of the contributors that I approached were because I knew them via Twitter. There are also people who I'd worked with in the UK who'd run marketing sessions, which I really thought were excellent, like Rosemary Stamp and Terry Kendrick. And then Alison Circle, for example, she writes for the Library Journal, the Bubble Room column, and I just read stuff of hers that I really, liked and wanted the sentiments of in the book. Rebecca Jones, who I'd met at the SLA conference in the US. It's just the classic thing of contacts that you've built up over a period of time. And there was a few where people put me in touch with people that they thought would be really useful. And in a couple of cases, I'd written most of the book and we had most of the case studies, but there was particular areas where I felt like I didn't have enough expertise to offer and I wanted expertise in the book. So I just asked on Twitter, can anyone put me in touch with people who are really good at X? And then people got in touch and we worked together to get the text ready for that. So it was really, it's my favourite thing about the book is the range of the case studies and, what a great list of people it is.
Right, and Twitter can really be really helpful in things like that of connecting people.
It's fantastic. It's absolutely fantastic. I can't, in terms of it's so worth finding the time. And I do understand people who say, I just don't have time for Twitter. But in a sense, it's like saying you don't have time to chat in the corridor, in a way, when you pass someone who you know. We've all got time for a quick little exchange of information, and you can just have a quick chat on Twitter and dip in and out. And when I first started on that, I used to think that you had to keep up with everything. I used to go back in the evenings and try and read what I'd missed, and I just couldn't get my head around the fact that you didn't have to do that. And people keep telling me, they were telling me for about a year, you don't have to, it's like a party, you wouldn't expect to go to a party and hear every single conversation that was taking place. It's fine, just let it go. And it took me ages to believe them, and now I'm fully signed up to that school of thought. But I think Twitter's fantastic for it's worth putting the time in to develop proper relationships and give a little of yourself in terms of not just having a completely professional existence but slightly personal as well without being so far and just having these relationships with people. It's just fantastic. I think it's brilliant. It's just been every day pretty much I will ask Twitter for something that I then use in my job. It's not just for the kind of the extracurricular activities. It's day to day. There is a pool of experts. It's like being at a conference all the time, except you can stand up with a loudspeaker and shout, "Does anyone know how to?" And then 3,000 librarians go, "Yeah, I do." It's just brilliant. It's fantastic.
And it's nice that it's a worldwide conference too. So you can...
yeah.
Opinions from all over the world.
exactly. It's just great. I love it.
And so how do you see social networks like Twitter being used by organizations to help them market themselves?
Well, I think it's a great opportunity because libraries traditionally have a reputation, and in many cases fair enough and well deserved, for being slightly austere, particularly in their communication. So there is this level of formality to do with the kind of the moral responsibility of libraries and to do with the fact that we want to be taken seriously. So there's this traditional kind of need to be, especially in the academic world, to be seen alongside faculty. And what this has led to is a very kind of formal method of communication. And particularly as, quite honestly, there's not a lot of ways around the fact that we have to tell people not to do stuff all the time. We're forever telling people that they can't return that there, or that they can't speak on their phones, or that they can't eat in the library, whatever. And, some of those are fair enough. But it does mean that a lot of our, signs essentially tell people not to do things. So you've got all this communication, which is formal and not always particularly positive. And for me, social media is a great opportunity to be the antidote to that, and to be friendly and colloquial and properly communicative. It's two-way, it's participatory, it's not a broadcast. And you can get to develop there's just no other way you could develop an understanding with your users without just constantly talking to them in real life, which is not always practical. So I think it's a fantastic opportunity, social media in general, Twitter in particular, because I think that the type of people who use libraries are often very willing to talk to libraries on Twitter, more so than on other networks, I would have said. And I just think that it's going to become more and more common. So we need to be there anyway. You know, we need to be where our users are to give them the messages, because that's what we're used to now as consumers. We're used to the stuff coming to us, and we don't have to go and seek it out. And it's also a great opportunity to be slightly different to what they normally get, and to be nice and friendly, and to give a better, you know, to improve the reputation of the institutions that we work in.
Right. Like you said, it lets you build up a conversation with your users, not just,
yeah,
not just, hey, we're having a program about e-readers. It's, hey, let's talk about what e-books are reading, and you can talk back and forth. And
asking questions is really important. I mean, I've noticed a lot of library Twitter accounts go on a kind of journey from being relatively formal and slightly stiff at first, because they're just, it's so hard not to be. And then over time, becoming more and more friendly. And sometimes it's difficult for the users to keep up. Sometimes they're used to us, you know, just doing the tweets about how we're having a program about X. And we want to turn it into a dialogue with them. So you have to ask them questions, and you have to be really explicit about it. Sometimes you have to actually ask for answers to your questions, as well as just asking the question, right, to really get through to people that you do want to communicate with them, as opposed to just, you know, the old style of communication, which is essentially to stand on top of a building and shout and hope that people are listening, whereas this is getting amongst people and having conversations with all of them at once. And over time, you'll find that, you know, people who are engaging or just followed the library on Twitter but didn't necessarily intend to engage with it will come around to the fact that the library is being more communicative and is actually wanting to engage directly with the users. And then something really interesting happens, and it becomes much more rewarding to do, quite apart from anything else. And you get really useful stuff out of it, and you get to know... the thing is, there are mechanisms for feeding back about the library, but they're fairly extreme in a way. You know, like a comments card. I wouldn't fill out a comments card unless I was enraptured with how wonderful something is or furious with how terrible it was. I just wouldn't bother, you know. Right. Whereas a tweet takes me half a second and I'm on there anyway. So you get nuggets of feedback and information and evaluation that you would never otherwise have unless you were literally walking around the library and overhearing conversations. So from that point of view, it really does open up a whole new kind of avenue for knowing how you're perceived and where you could make changes to better help people and what they're missing. You know, you hear, if you run a search on your library's name or any kind of colloquialisms for the name on Twitter, and you can hear you can read the conversations people are having about the library without addressing the library directly. And you get a really good insight into, you know, whether people are actually complaining that you don't do X when you do do X, in which case you can tell those people that you do it, and you can make that a more obvious point in your promotion elsewhere. You know, it's a really useful thing, and there's no other way of doing the stuff that social media allows you to do, really. It allows you to do a lot of the traditional marketing things, but it also allows you to do a lot of other stuff which you can't do elsewhere.
Yeah, I liked what you did with the book, even, of you have the site that supplements it, and you have a Twitter account that supplements it, and you're still updating that and keeping current, you're putting new case studies, things like that. So it's sort of keeping, so you have the book, which is sort of the core of it, and then you have this supplement that keeps the ideas going.
Exactly. I mean, it's such a good opportunity to, you know, to have content that changes and is updatable, because a book takes so long to publish that it's already starting to go out of date by the time it arrives on the shelves, you know. And the idea of, I mean, it's not just that things go out of date. The advice in the book about how to use social media is still true, even though it was published in, you know, July 2012, nearly 7 or 8 months ago. But it's about how the landscape shifts and new tools come along. And, you know, there's only so much room for stuff in a book. There's a strict word limit, which I completely failed to stick to, as it was. And so it allows you to talk about new tools and get new perspectives. You know, my network of people that I know via Twitter changes and grows, and I meet new people, and I think, wow, I would love to have had their voice in the book. But now I've got the website, which allows their voices to be heard in, you know, future case studies and so on. We've got a case study coming up from the Unlibrary, which is a kind of the more controversial end of the rebranding spectrum. It's a library in the UK which is called the Unlibrary, and it's all about, it's a bit like what David Lankus was talking about in the last one of these that I listened to, about how a library should be a space where people come to do what they feel passionate about. And the Unlibrary is a space for ideas, to nurture ideas and to bring people together and to connect people. And it's the very modern kind of extreme rebranding of the library as not being a library. And that's really interesting. And some people sort of find it a bit worrying. Some people find it fascinating. So there's a really interesting case study, which I'm about to put up on the... Oh, just broke my desk a bit there. about to put up on the website. It's great to be able to include those kind of perspectives even after the fact of the book being, set in stone and written in the paper.
Is there any big library marketing campaign that you think really worked?
Well, there's a couple. I mean, the most recent one is the have you seen that video on YouTube from the library that took on the Tea Party? Have you seen that?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that really got me excited, because they had this whole thing where, you know, taxes were going to be raised. It was going to be, a cut in the library. And there was this whole rhetoric that the Tea Party were putting out. And it was really difficult for libraries to fight back against. And they did it in the most brave way possible, where they kind of had this pretend book burning campaign, which was really brave and got people really fired up and, you know, saying the library was sick because they were going to burn all the books. And it swung the public opinion around. Mm-hmm. And then the library revealed it was, you know, it was actually, the whole thing was their idea. And then they defeated the powers of the Tea Party in the vote, and the library didn't have a reduction in budget. I mean, that was, I didn't really explain that very well. people should go and look it up because it's amazing.
I'll post a link to it in the show notes.
Okay, fantastic, yeah. That really got me excited because it was so brave and you know, almost kind of counterintuitive for what you'd expect from a library. But just in terms of more traditional marketing campaigns, a Cagliari Public Library in Canada used the kind of tools that a for-profit organisation would use, where they advertise. They did things like pressure washing their logo into the pavements. They advertised in grocery stores. And they linked their advertising to the grocery, so they'd have their logo next to some bananas, and then they'd have some, you know, relevant piece of text on the marketing. I think they put their logo and slogan on trucks. They did proper, you know, traditional advertising, and it worked really well. And it actually changed local perception of the library and made not just more people aware of it, because most people know that there is a library, but changed the way people thought about it. And it wasn't just a kind of basic marketing, see the logo on the pavement and then go to the library. It was more about making people more aware that the library was kind of interesting and dynamic and human, and making them think about it. And then, you know, those potentially useful things the library could do to them suddenly come to the forefront of their mind, and they think, right, the library is the place that I'm going to go and try and achieve whatever it is that they want to achieve. So I was really impressed with that, because it was, it was a traditional marketing campaign with advertising, with slogans, and it worked really well. It worked really well.
That's great. You've got a new column for Library Journal that you're involved with. Can you talk about what that is and how you got involved with that?
Yeah, I mean, I was really excited about this. There is four of us, I think, and we're kind of on rotation, writing about marketing and advocacy over the course of the year. So we each write, I think, three columns a year. And we were just approached by the editor, and you know, he was looking for more voices to write about marketing and advocacy because it's such an important area. So that's started, I think, in November was the first one. Then mine was in December. There's another one in January and so on. And it's just it's a really good opportunity to write in a publication that lots of people read.
But you are not the annoyed librarian, right?
Oh, no, I'm not the annoyed librarian. I don't know how I feel about the annoyed librarian. I kind of miss the Because I think people think there's been more than one. Is that right? You know, so it's the kind of the persona has been taken on by more than one individual.
Right, and
I think
right. There's a group.
I missed the first one that everyone thought was really good, and I kind of came along to it too late when people were all a bit jaded. I get wary of people who I think there is a very important role to criticize constructively what we're doing in libraries and make sure we don't fall into the trap of just being so nice that we say everything's good and so in the mold of we must defend libraries that we never flag up anything for being bad. But at the same time, there is a certain part of the library community that seem to take delight. Look at these bunch of losers doing X, as opposed to we as a community need to focus on Y. That it just becomes... It ceases to be constructive dialogue. It's a waste of opportunity. If you are the annoyed librarian and you've got the chance to say something really great, it's a shame when it is just, you know, slagging something off.
I think it comes across as, at this point, it's sort of relentless pessimism. It's just...
Yeah, exactly. And there's a fine, you know, we have enough of that. We also have enough of relentless kind of blind optimism as well. I think, as with so many things, it's somewhere in the middle that we need to be. It's horrible to be surrounded by the pessimism all the time, but at the same time, it would be naive just to not be pessimistic about anything and assume that everything's going to be absolutely fine, because then we wouldn't take any actions to try and make things better, you know? So there's a middle ground, as with all things.
Well, Ned, how can people find out more about you and the book online?
Basically, librarymarketingtoolkit.com is the site for the book. So, it has information about the book and about the contributors, British Library and New York Public Library and David Lee King and all that stuff. And then it has new case studies as we add them. And there's a blog there to take on things that are happening recently in the world of marketing libraries. And then my own kind of personal website is thewikiman.org, which is where I tend to write about the non-marketing stuff, although occasionally some marketing-y things slip in there, just about librarianship in general.
All right. Well, Ned, thank you so much for talking to me, and I hope people run out and grab the book and check out your site and learn more about it and apply it to their own libraries.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a great pleasure.
All right. Talk to you later.
Okay.
Bye. If you'd like to learn more about the podcast, you can visit circulatingideas.com. Or you can follow the show on Twitter @CircIdeas or on Tumblr @circulatingideas.tumblr.com. You can also like the show on Facebook @facebook.com/circulatingideas. And if you have comments, questions, or suggestions for future interviews, you can contact the show @circulatingideas.mail@gmail.com. Music is by Pamela Klicka. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll join me again next time.